Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
That's just a little bit of the sound from this week's funeral services for President George H.W. Bush, who passed away this past weekend. The nation has mourned his 41st president, and it was quite touching and quite impressive the way people sort of evoked memories and experiences with the 41st president. To help us start this conversation about a little bit about the president, I've got two buddies who I've always been impressed by and so happy they can join today. Mona Sharon is a syndicated columnist and a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Her most recent book is Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. Yay, folks, you got to pick that one up. Yep, it's mandatory reading. Welcome, Mona.
Hey, thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
And joining us is Ellis Hennigan. Now, this guy, he and I have tussled from time to time. He is a New York Times bestselling author, a Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper columnist, and a popular TV news pundit. Imagine that. He is also the voice of Stormy. Now, not Stormy Daniels, just so we're clear. Stormy on the hit Cartoon Network series C-Lab 2020. His upcoming book, co-written with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Now, folks, you know there's some knockdown going on there. Let Me Finish, Trump, the Kushners, Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics. Ellis Hennigan, welcome to the Man of Steel podcast, bro.
Hey, good to be with you guys. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you both. And before we get into politics and culture and all the other good things that are going on, I wanted to get your thoughts, your impressions on President 41, Bush 41, as we have affectionately come to call him, his legacy and his time as president, particularly as we kind of look back on it now through probably more rose-colored glasses than we were wearing at the time he was in office or shortly thereafter. Mona, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would separate George W. Bush, the man, from his presidency, because I think that part of the reason for the nostalgia and for the warm feelings that we're all expressing this week about his life and his passing is that he was something that Americans used to admire. That is, he was a gentleman. He was honorable. He married his high school sweetheart and stayed married to her for, I think, 73 years.
Yeah.
There was never a breath of scandal about him. He was all about service. All of those things are, let us say, not quite so admired anymore and not quite in such abundant supply. And so I think that is the main reason, rather than any particular accomplishments of his presidency, which I think was a mixed bag on it, quite honestly. But I do think that that's the reason. It was because of his personal qualities, sterling personal qualities, let me say, mm-hmm. including being a war hero, that have caused us to really remember him with so much appreciation.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Ellis, what are your thoughts, man?
Well, that's right. First of all, let's acknowledge that we do pump very well in this country. Right,
I mean, we do
not as well as the British.
Yeah, it's funny. I think we take no second seat to the British on this kind of stuff. I mean, it was moving, right? And what was moving about it, Mona's right, was not any policy discussion or any, you know, hardball analysis of the pluses and minuses of the presidency, but that, you know, he was a decent guy.
Yeah.
And I will say this, decency, you know, it looks better every single day. What you could not get away from the coverage is where I know this conversation is heading, which is that no matter what you say about a former president, it's hard not to look at it through the lens of the one we have today. And George H.W. Bush, like I say, he's looking better by the hour.
Well, and I think that's kind of the impression I pick up from folks over the last few days as the ceremonies began to unfold. And you're right. I mean, we do state funerals very well. And we don't get to do the royal marriage thing, but we can bury some people. But as those storylines were starting to unfold, a narrative that is largely written by the president himself, I mean, because they plan out how these ceremonies go, who's invited, who speaks. So we as citizens are kind of, as we tend to be, observers here, and we get to reflect. And what I thought was very interesting, to your point, Ellis, was that people in their reflection, they didn't really spend much time talking about the policy ups and downs and mishaps of the Bush years. Yes, they talked a lot about the wall coming down because that was a significant moment. But, you know, I thought that there would have been a lot more, and got asked about it at least just once, I think, in the course of my coverage about, the no new taxes pledge, which was a real break with the Republican Party and started to, exacerbate the sort of fraying ends of the party post Reagan. So you have Trump standing in stark contrast to all of that. And so people, I think that glow is a lot brighter for someone like Bush in the face of a Donald Trump. I'd be curious what the reaction would have been or how the coverage would have played itself out if, you know, a Jeb Bush were president or a Hillary Clinton were president. And whether or not the sentimentality probably would have been as strong, but I think there probably would have been a different emphasis on some of the policy stuff.
I don't think it would have been quite as strong under other circumstances if we had another president.
Interesting.
And I do think, for example, I mean, again, not to be uncharitable to the dead, but really just to be in pure analytical mode. I think George H.W. Bush was a wonderful man and a good leader in many respects. But I mean, his betrayal of that no new taxes pledge really could be interpreted as part of what made the American public, or at least the Republican side of it, ever more cynical about politics.
Yeah.
It was a huge promise to renege on. He couldn't have been more explicit, and then to just turn around and rebuke the voters that way was, I think, it was a serious blunder.
Yeah, listen, you can draw a straight line from the breaking of that pledge to Newt Gingrich to the Tea Party to Trumpism, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can.
Yeah.
And the struggles, Michael, that someone like you had running the Republican Party in that era, you know, those forces, those harder and to me look like darker forces.
They were motivated by that.
I'm sorry.
They were pissed off at least.
Yeah. No, for sure. That is really true. And so, you know, listen, we all struggle. And Mona knows this, having spent so many years in the print side of our business. You know, when somebody dies and they're freshly dead, you know, do you want to bring up the bad stuff?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I don't think that's the day to pound somebody, you know, while they're freshly deceased. But if we're going to have an intelligent conversation about it, you're right. We got to go a little beyond, oh, he was a lovely guy and his family sure loved him.
Yeah. And I think that there was, I guess, almost a struggle for a lot of folks to try to reconcile that in some respects because of just the pure animosity towards Bush. They just felt like, towards Trump, Bush was much better than Trump. So I'm good. I don't have to say anything negative about Bush because I make that up for what I say about Trump.
Well, Michael, I've been praising W lately. I mean, he's looking better too.
Right.
Come on.
Right. Well, and exactly right. And one of the most interesting moments for me, there were several, but the most interesting was, of course, watching the front row. Where you had the three former presidents and their first ladies sitting and waiting for the ceremonies to begin. They're chatting amongst themselves, the Clintons and the Obamas, the Clintons and the Carters, and everybody's kind of a little chatty Cathy, having fun, relatively speaking. You know, they're being very nice. Trump comes in and they all went stone face. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you could tell by the look on Michelle Obama's face, who did not at first extend her hand to shake the president, Trump's hand, but was after a sort of forced moment where she had to recognize he was there, she turned and had this look like, really? You're going to make me do this? Really?
You know, this is, Michael, this is a really delicate social thing. Have you thought about this? I mean, look, Trump is a contemptible human being, and people are justified in feeling that they don't want to grant him any honors or courtesies. On the other hand, he's such a buffoon and such a boob and such a rude human being. But do you want to descend to his level? Right. If he extends his hand, you don't want to be like him.
Right.
And so, right. And so therefore, I think you're sort of in a situation of thinking, all right, you know, I will shake his hand just so that I can have the minimum amount of politeness, but I don't have to chat.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a
rule about that. Be polite at least until the funeral is over.
Yeah.
And then you can go outside and talk trash. Let me just say, my mother would not have wanted me to ignore the hand in the funeral, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I give her credit. I give her credit for that. And you could tell, you know, that was one of those things that kicked in. But there was a moment where she thought about it. And her face expressed her thinking about it. And I just started laughing. Yeah. But even better than Mrs. Obama was Hillary Clinton, who did not even turn to acknowledge Donald Trump. She did. She acknowledged Melania. She was doing that, you know, Hillary Clinton nod thing. And then when Melania pulled back, Trump was standing there, Hillary looked straight ahead. And it just speaks to a broader chasm that is a growing one, I think, between this president and the former presidents, who in the past, these folks rely on each other. They do tend to support one another, particularly the incumbent, as much as possible. But Trump didn't even make the effort to welcome each of the presidents to Washington and to the cathedral, which would have been like George Bush did when he came in. It was just that moment on the front row to me was very telling.
You know, speaking of presidents relying on one another, there's an interesting story about JFK calling upon Eisenhower. Now, they didn't have the greatest relationship,
right,
especially during the campaign. Eisenhower was not at all pleased with what Kennedy was saying, you know, like out with the old, in with the new kind of stuff. Right.
Right.
But after he was president, he did call upon Ike for advice. And at one point, they met privately, and Ike basically read him the riot act and said, "You are immature. You don't know how to command people. You are, you know, you're out of your depth," and blah, blah, blah. And to his everlasting credit, and I have my criticisms, of course, of JFK, but to his everlasting credit, Kennedy said, "Thank you. I mean, he actually appreciated the feedback. Can you imagine somebody saying that to Trump and Trump saying, you know, thanks, that's helpful. Yeah.
Constructive criticism. Right. You know what, you know what else done to my mind watching those presidents there? It will not, and I don't mean to be bleak about this, but it won't be long before we have a Jimmy Carter funeral.
Right.
And how will the treatment of his presidency and Carter as a person compare to that of George H.W. Bush, right? Two one-term presidents, flawed presidencies, pretty much, I think, under any definition. Deeply decent people. And I just, it'd be interesting to see how that coverage compares.
You know what? I just a quick point on that. I think what will lift up the Carter presidency will be all the work that had nothing to do with his presidency. And that is his Habitat for Humanity work. I mean, you've got this 90-year-old guy out there building houses, you know, hammering nails. And look, I can barely get out of bed in the morning, and he's out there, you know, building a house. And I think his humanitarian work, both domestically and globally, I think will do a lot to sort of massage whatever recriminations may exist from his time as president, with the hostage crisis, the flagging economy, the malaise perspective that he had of what was going on in America at the time. And it really kind of put him in a different position. And I thought a little bit of that happened with George Bush, too. He became much more of a grandfather for a lot of Americans, if you will, post-presidency. In terms of how they look back on him, then I think if let's say, you know, he had passed earlier or closer to the end of his presidency, I think to your point, Ellis, it would have been a starker commentary about his presidency.
Michael, can I just have a brief? I agree with you about the Habitat for Humanity stuff and so on, but I will just have to demur a little bit on Jimmy Carter's post-presidency, because he. He's been absolutely nasty and bad on Israel.
Well,
I mean,
true.
He wrote a book called Peace, Not Apartheid, where he basically accused Israel of being equivalent to South Africa, which was just a disgrace. So just had to put that in there.
No. And I think that's a fair point. And I think that's going to be one of the stretching moments in sort of applying his post-presidency to his presidency. You're going to find those little pinpricks, like you just described, that will also then, I think, relate people back to this is what we didn't like about Jimmy Carter when he was president.
But you know, you can't, in all of this, though, you can't get away from the fact that Donald Trump is a president today.
Right.
And we look at all of these guys through that lens. Right. I always joked in life that it's always great to follow a turkey in a job. Right. The person who used to have the job that you just gotten is terrible. It makes you look good.
Right.
I guess there's a corollary that if the guy who comes after you is terrible, that also makes you look better.
Right. Right. So that's the goal, positioning. You know, it's
they claim that the Emperor Tiberius chose Caligula as his successor for that very reason.
Right. Yeah. Oh, there's so many appropriate. Okay, we'll move on from that one. So let's shift gears a little bit. You know, in terms of the news of the week, clearly the presidential funeral took a lot of that place and space. But we are now in a new space where we have Robert Mueller, the erstwhile special counsel who has been reviewing and looking into the relationship of the pre-Trump administration, post-Trump administration to Russia, and the role all of the relevant players played in what could amount to some form of coordination, collusion about the 2016 election, and I suspect a whole lot more. So there's not just this idea that you know, the problem was explicitly with the Russians' involvement in the election. But I also think there's a money trail that the special counsel has gotten a hold of. Well, he's now set to file new disclosures as of the end of this week. And folks have spent a large part of this day kind of waiting for that to happen. And it's basically revolving around two of President Donald Trump's former close associates, both of whom have entered guilty pleas, lest the record reflect otherwise, in that Russia meddling probe going back to the 2016 election. Now, Mueller's, from what we understand, is expected to recommend a sentence for his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, who's already sort of said, you know, no mas, whatever you need, Mr. Prosecutor, I'm going to give you. And all of that's going to come ahead of the federal judge's final sentencing decision on Tuesday, in which they've recommended no jail time for Cohen. And of course, the other is Paul Manafort, who has come back and said, screw you, special counsel. And I suspect they're going to throw the book at him. What's your take, folks, on this whole drama around Mueller, the president, and these cast of characters who keep falling? As much as, you know, Trump says there's nobody there, a whole lot of people are pleading guilty to stuff that apparently didn't happen, according to Trump.
If it's all a witch hunt, there certainly are a lot of witches.
There are.
Right. Yeah. We, of course, are not privy to this. And it's worth mentioning that one of the themes that you often see among Trump defenders is, well, obviously they haven't found anything because we would know about it by now. So obviously there's nothing there. And, you know, that strikes me as really silly. I mean, we have never seen a more closed mouth, tight-lipped operation than the Mueller team. They have just been silent. The only way that Mueller speaks is when he presents his filings in court. Other than that, it's been silent as a tomb. And so we don't know, but we do know that he's a by-the-book prosecutor and that if he hadn't found anything, he would have closed up shop. So I think this notion that he didn't find anything and therefore, because it hasn't leaked, it's just something that ought to be retired.
Yeah, that's right. Let me be clear about one thing, though. I'm in favor of leaks, so I don't want to go too high and mighty about how wonderful it is that Mueller doesn't leak.
My number is available, by the way, if anybody wants to leak to me.
Exactly. To start catching on, let me just be clear about that.
I love it. Says the two journalists here.
I tell you what strikes me about it, though. Amid all of the denouncing of the investigation, the Mona and Michael, you all both alluding to, I think it's worth remembering that these practices, the way the prosecutor has operated here, is utterly routine practice in the prosecution of federal criminal law, right? The idea of taking somebody who is a lower level offender, flipping him, using him to testify against those above him. The notion that somehow that's improper or unfair or ought to be banned is simply preposterous, and it's belied by the fact that that's the way the system operates every day. I mean, for instance, does Rudy Giuliani really believe that there's something improper about turning a witness against a higher up? Because his entire career as a United States attorney has been built on that very principle. I just think there's an awful lot of kind of selfish hypocrisy in those analyses.
I agree with that, and I think the point that you make, Mona, is. Spot on as well in terms of, look, the fact of the matter is, from what I know of Mueller and from people who know him personally and have worked with him personally, this is not a guy who's going to spend 18 months plus only to come to nothing. He took a look at this, from what I understand, from people who are familiar with this part of the process and realize, yeah, there's something to move forward on here. And the reasons, you know, that's the case because he then made a massive referral to the New York prosecutors. He passed off stuff to them as well. The stuff that probably fell outside of the purview of his investigation, he gave to them. So this idea in Trump land that this is a witch hunt, that there's no there is just not true, number one. And number two, do you really think that if even after all of this, Mueller says, no, there's nothing here to prosecute and move on, that the prosecutors in the state of New York don't have stuff they can look? They just go to the New York Times story that laid out the criminal enterprise known as Trump, you know, the Trump family, if you will, to sort of bring those state charges. So,
but don't you think, Michael, that if the wrongdoing that Mueller discovers vis-a-vis Trump himself is merely a matter of him having cheated the government out of taxes and other things like that when he was a businessman, those arguably are not impeachable offenses.
Correct.
Because they preceded, right, the presidency.
Correct.
And the voters were fully aware that Correct. This was a sketchy guy.
Yep.
When they voted for, right. So I think the only things that would be considered impeachable would be things that were either happening during the campaign or immediately after.
Yeah.
We need to remember, though, impeachable standard means almost nothing, right? I mean, it's whatever.
Well, I'm speaking of it politically. Yeah. You're right. I mean, it's not a legal doctrine. It doesn't. There are no objective standards. It's a political judgment.
Yeah.
But that's, so I'm making a political judgment about how I think the because you would need Republican votes to remove him from office. And there wouldn't be those unless it was something that really betrayed some kind of treasonous or other activity that was really, really serious.
No, you're absolutely right about that. If you want to find an answer, go look at what the lineup in the Senate is, right? And it's hard to, it's got to be something pretty egregious.
Yeah.
To make even if he does get impeached in the House, and we know that that isn't the, you know, that's not the end of the story, as we discovered in the Clinton years.
Yeah.
But it's the legal standard thing is, I don't know that how much light it really sheds on it.
Right. No, there really isn't a legal. I mean, in Madison and in the debates about the Constitution, spoke of impeachment as a political matter.
Yeah.
He said it would be, you know, a matter of the Congress deciding what's unacceptable behavior. He didn't say it had to be, you know, a particular crime.
Right. And I think that's and so where this gets convoluted, I think, is when people try to apply sort of the constitutional origins of impeachment and as a political issue. They try to conflate it into something that's legal and consequential in terms of the judiciary and getting, you know, subpoena the president and all this other stuff. And as everyone knows, I mean, this is the impeachment process is a purely political process.
Yeah.
With a pretty high bar. And, you know, Trump seems to do everything in his power to exceed that bar.
As my friend and colleague Yuval Levin noted just the other day, one of the things that Madison imagined would be an impeachable offense would be the misuse of the pardon power for the president to use it to pardon his own associates.
Good luck on that.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But, you know, before we get there, though, don't forget the question of meddling with Mueller gets more intense by the hour. Right. As we now are knowing that that Bill Barr is going to be the nominee for attorney general, someone who has tweeted and spoken and written pretty forcefully that he doesn't support some of the kinds of investigations we're getting at Mueller. You know, is he going to be able to finish this? Is there some kind of steps are going to be taken? What Whitaker might have wanted to do, Barr may be able to do. Does that make the Senate be more likely to act? I don't. To me, those are suddenly urgent questions.
And will the Senate, during his confirmation hearings, extract a promise that he will not interfere?
And Mona, that's what surprises me about the announcement of Barr today at this time, because I thought for sure they would wait on that so that you get past this whole idea of asking the president's nominee whether or not he would find a way, a back door for the president, thinking that, and I know the Trump people were probably thinking this, that Mueller's responses would be out on the street by then and they'd have a lot of cover. But I still say Mueller's not going to probably pull the remaining triggers until sometime next year, because I think he still has some investigating to do because he's getting new stuff. And so I kind of forced the president's hand almost to move on Barr sooner rather than later. And maybe he's thinking that's going to be a clearer shot for him, to your point, Ellis, to obstruct without really obstructing.
Yeah, you know how I would have assumed that the way they would do it was let Whitaker come in and do all the dirty work, right? I mean, let him take the heat. Then you say, well, he's the temporary guy. He's gone. And now we bring in, you know, more of a credible statesman. But it doesn't seem like it's going to happen that way. I think this is moving a little quicker than I thought.
You almost get the impression that they don't think things through in the White House.
Oh, no.
Never crossed my mind. No, that is something I never thought. All right, so before I let you guys get out of here, I've got one more. And Mona, this is more for you, I guess, in the sense as a conservative, thinker and writer, and someone who has a fond appreciation of constitutional principles and ideas. What's happening in Wisconsin, to me, I would love to get your thoughts, where the legislature has decided to gut the powers of the incoming Democratic. The Republican legislature is gutting the power and authority of the incoming Republican governor, Democratic governor, as more or less a payback for what the Democrats did to Scott Walker when he came
in 2009.
So what's your take on that as a reflection of where our politics is right now?
Right. So this is, the perpetual whataboutism. If you say, Republicans, this is dirty pool, don't do this, they'll say, but what about when the Democrats did it to Walker?
Right.
And this is an endless spiral down the drain, right? I mean, at a certain point, you just have to say, no, I won't do it because I'm me and I have my own standards. And I, even though the other side did it, I'm going to rise above it. And I think it's unseemly. I think it's legal, but it violates the spirit of the democratic idea that when the voters have spoken, at that point, you don't countermand the voters' will in such an obvious way. And so while it's, and this is the importance of norms again, because there's, as I said, it's perfectly legal for the legislature to do this, but it's not right. And our politicians, all of us in society have to be governed by more than just the letter of the law. We have to be governed by norms and values and expectations and things where you just don't want to be a jerk.
Yeah, that's very well put. Ellis, I would allow you to answer that as well, but we've gutted your time as a Democrat, so you're not permitted to.
Well, I'll admire Mona's moral center and leave it at that.
Thank you.
Mona Sharon, Ellis Hennekin, thank you both for spending a little time with the Man of Steel. Really appreciate your insights and wish you guys the best. Folks, if you get a chance, definitely pick up Mona's most recent book, Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. And Mr. Hennekin, hell of a title, working with Governor Chris Christie, New Jersey. Their book, Let Me Finish, Trump, the Kushner's Bannon, New Jersey, and the Power of In-Your-Face Politics, which I like and know a little bit about as well. So we appreciate
great being with you guys.
Yeah, right, guys. Loved it. Thank you so much.
Take care now. Well, that does it for now, folks. So glad you could be with us. And again, I thank my guests, Mona Sharon and Ellis Hennekin. Guys, it's the holiday season, and we're all thinking about giving and sharing. Sometimes the best gift that you can give is an opportunity that could change someone's life. That's why our friends at Transatlantic Real Estate have created an investment opportunity for the everyday investor. Here's the deal. We all know that legal marijuana has created one of the fastest growing industries in this country. We also know that crowdfunding makes it easy to get in early on an investment opportunity. MarijuanaStock.org combines the two. They buy land that supports marijuana grow operations and leases it to licensed high-paying tenants, so you can invest in the landlord of a licensed marijuana farm in a high-growth market. Act now and you can participate for as little as $300 before the company goes public. Just go to MarijuanaStock.org to complete and confirm your application to participate. Don't just buy a gift this holiday season. Get an investment opportunity for someone special. To get started, go to MarijuanaStock.org. That's MarijuanaStock.org. I'm Michael Steele. This is the Man of Steel podcast. And of course, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Until next time, this is the Man of Steel.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.